Okay, thank you. So, and thanks for organizing this workshop. I really very much enjoyed it. And I can at least see a few people not working with plants here, so we'll see if I can teach them something. So I have two caveats. So one is of course that I work a lot with both Elliot and Marcus, so I will overlap with some of the topics. But in those cases, I will try to do more coming from the dynamical point of view. So I have I'm a physicist by training, and then switch towards biology. So I kind of start with the model in my head, and then put names on things and so on. And the other one is that I added quite a lot of different topics, which means I'll be a little bit superficial. But I'm around today and tomorrow for further discussions where we can discuss the details in more. As I mentioned, I come from physics, and of course you see lots of plants and the beauty of plants and all the patterns and all the colors, and in particular the kind of mathematical symmetries. And then you go to the lab and the plant looks like this. So it is maybe not as beautiful, you may say, but as Marcus showed yesterday, is that these mathematical symmetries and the pattern forming is very much as beautiful in this plant as in the other one I showed. So I focus a lot on the shoot meristem, just as Marcus and Elliot. And my long-term ambition is here to try to explain as much as possible at once, in a single model, more or less. Not explaining everything, but to try to take some of the basic mechanisms that we have found, and then also try to integrate what happens if you put a radial patterning together with a phyllotaxis model and these kind of questions. But what you have to understand, and what of course Marcus and others have shown, is that it is really a dynamical problem if you look over a few days. So here we have a shoot apical meristem from above. The green marks what we define as the stem cells. It's the Clavada 3 region. The aim now for us is to really follow the cells over time and see if we can explain the dynamics. And also, we don't think we understand it unless we can make a model of what we see. So quite often we now try to do a segmentation, a 3D segmentation of the tissue, and really track the cells over time. And it's kind of annoying experiments because we cannot follow them automatically, so we have to move the plants back to the growth chamber in between data points. And as you can see, it can go for 80 hours, so it's not so easy for a single postdoc to do this. Sometimes they try, but most of the time you need to kind of team up in several people. And then today also I will talk about, if I have time, early flower development, so where we do a similar kind of approach and where we have gone a little bit further to try to create a template that we can use then to build models out of. But what I would like to kind of... see how they come down in random order. The way I would like to kind of phrase the problem is from the plant cell perspective. So I had in the title the power of non-moving plant cells, which is kind of Darwin's book, The Power of Movement of Plants. But you are very much a cell, and if we follow this blue cell here, we can see that it moves a little bit further and further out from the center because it gets pushed by its neighbors. And while doing this, it kind of divides. And here it has divided into six, a clone of six. Then when it comes to the periphery, it can be recruited to a flower. So then again, if we take one of the cells now on the side of the meristem and follow that one while the flower develops, we can see that one then, I now marked some genes here to just give a kind of a spatial sense here. But we can see it starts kind of on the inside of the flower. In the end, the clone it creates is on the outer sepals. So what do the cells need to sense in terms of signals, and what does it have to do to be able to kind of create all these patterns? Because it has to change growth, it has to change gene expression while it listens, and might have to produce hormones and morphogens, etc., at the same time as it listens to it. So the idea, again, is a little bit that we don't In the models, we typically start with a single one of these. Yeah.
Could you just please go back one slide? I'm just trying to make sure I understand what to pay attention to. So you started with this...
So this is the side of the meristem. That is a little bit of bulge here, but you hardly can see that this is going to be a flower. Mm-hmm. I pick one cell here, mm-hmm. and then I track this one. And here it stays on the upper side, but in the end, it ends up on the outer sepal.
But in particular, right, so there is this green territory, and it's all clonal too?
Yeah, so the green one we have marked. So this is kind of manually marking the rev. As Marcus described yesterday, the rev goes into the flower initially. But in the final time point here, it has kind of completely reorganized. So it's still on the inside of these organs. It's still in the center
so
of the
So that's gene expression. It's not just marking a clone of cells.
Yeah. So these are manually created gene expression data. And I will come to that towards the end in terms of what we want to do with this. But the idea is that, for example, we might have a gene regulatory model. We might have a phyllotaxis model based on hormones. Or we might have a growth model based on mainly mechanics. And we really think these has to interact to be able to do things. And then I will also discuss a little bit cell divisions. So I thought I'll start a little bit from the beginning. So now if you're a cell at the center of the meristem, so how do you grow? And what you can show is that you grow exponentially. So this is kind of the relative growth for all the cells binned according to the stage in the cell cycle. And we can see it stays quite constant, reduces a little bit towards the end. Here, it's the log growth here, so it's an exponential growth. And what we can see is the yellow ones are actually more to the periphery. So the further out you are in this meristem, the faster you're growing. And here's some data from the Kwiatkowska lab, where they show also that in the periphery, you also have like started to get some anisotropic growth. So you grow faster, which the color indicates and those indicate, but you also have selected a direction of growth. So how can we explain that? And again, the plant has to grow into shape. So again, there are not too many maybe animal mechanical people around now, but we really have to forget about how animal tissue kind of deforms, and we have to forget about this active contractive type of behavior, cell migration, the cell reorganization is not there, they never slide, and there is no growth by cell division. So I kind of see it as...
Okay, so I don't understand what you mean by there's no growth by cell division.
So, okay, I will show you a little bit later in terms of the way I kind of interpret this, in that the division event by itself does not lead to growth. Mm-hmm. So in principle, if we look at the cytoskeleton in these cells, we could claim that they are quite weak. The cell walls are holding all the stresses and are the kind of rigid elements that you have to deform to be able to grow. On the other hand, as has been shown as well, is that they still have some power. So since the microtubules will affect the cell walls, then the cells can guide the microtubules to do something that will actually affect your growth. So I thought this should be a very quick one when talking about growth, but then I ended up adding lots and lots of slides of this. But let's see where we go. But so I just reiterate the kind of the basic assumptions, and that is that growth is driven by pressure. And in our case, we usually look at the epidermis. So part of this can come from the cells inside as well that grow. And don't hold back completely the pressure. And how can you then grow anisotropically? The idea is then that you have cellulose fibers in the walls that can align in specific direction and become much more rigid in this direction. And that allows you to grow in one direction, although you have the pressure acting similar in all ways. And here comes the thing then that the microtubules are helping to orient the microfibers. So the main question then is what is organizing these microtubules? And again, I kind of repeat what people have described as our kind of main hypothesis or assumption in these models, and we can see how far can that take us in terms of growth patterns and so on. So I always have some low resolution things, but you have a meristem and a primordia growing, you can see very strong alignment in the boundary in between, and if you look at the sides, it also looks like it's circumferential, the microtubules. And if we do an ablation, that they will reorganize to move around. And again, we don't have any stress tensors and so on, but what we can do is we can block it. So we can, if we remove severing of microtubules and do the same experiment, they will not reorganize. So we can kind of block what we think is the feedback here between the stress, microtubules, and then the fibers. And then if we look at our stress models, that kind of predict the microtubule patterns quite well, as we have shown in different things. So here's now what we use in this kind of first set of models is that we will say that stresses will influence the microfibrils via the microtubules, and that will change our mechanical properties of the cell wall material. And in this case, the K is the magnitude of the anisotropy, and A is the kind of direction of anisotropy.
Is there some sort of directional degradation of the woody layer outside the cells that is coordinated with the microtubule, the fibrils inside, so that there's directed degradation or something?
That I don't think we know. So in the models, we kind of, and it's kind of shown in experiment also, for some reason, the latest laid out fibers seems to be more important for growth directions, at least. So in the models, we kind of assume we add new all the time, and somehow they degrade because, yeah, you get an expansion, of course, so you get a dilution, but in at least the time scales we are looking at, it doesn't look like the wall is kind of becoming less thick or anything like that. But we don't use any kind of idea of active degradation of something here.
So how uniform is growth? So now growth defined as expansion of the surface, right? So presumably you can track cells over a few days,
yep,
and construct the flow field and then take the divergence of it and see how uniformly and not uniformly you're adding area.
Yeah, if I go back to the data here. So here we are following the kind of clones generated from one. And here we can see it looks on a log scale, so it looks kind of exponential over time. Mm-hmm. Here you can see, here we take all the cells and we pool them on where they are in their cell cycle and normalize the growth to the size. And what we can see, if we now look at the relative growth, is that it looks like an exponential in average. If we would take a single cell and just plot the kind of growth curves, it would look very noisy. And this is volume. So this is kind of what Adrian showed, that if you take cell by cell, there is a variation.
Right, and I guess
at specific.
I guess the question is, right, the thing is woody, right? So somehow you think that if it expands, it has to expand very coherently, right?
Yeah.
And then the question is, say the fast cell is expanding rapidly, what is happening to the neighbors?
Yeah,
so they actually shrink so that the change in area is confined to near vicinity.
So
right? Are there anti-correlations in growth at short distances?
So there is a paper suggesting that there is this kind of feedback between your neighbors, that if you grow a little bit faster, your neighbors react by aligning with the stresses, and that stops the growth, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make a model of this. I'm a little bit worried that model allow for the shrinking of cells. But it's kind of an animal-based model they use.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, I never shrink. But relatively growth can be slower. So in principle, the thing can work as long as you grow. But I never allow them to shrink.
But it's not just a matter of a model. You have a lot of data to analyze.
Yeah.
I'm just curious what ones.
We haven't in this data. We haven't looked at this kind of thing. In that paper, I think they actually had data also suggesting this, that there was the feedback on the fast growing cells.
Oh. Just asking whether the people who also collected data, we've never seen.
I guess I wasn't imagining shrinking necessarily, but the slower rate of growth of a neighbor, the neighbors are faster growing.
Yeah, but that shrinking is hard. That we heard from Adrienne's data the other day. She showed fluctuation in growth rates.
But not anti-correlations, right?
It's exactly. The correlations were discussed. So it's been suggested that there is a short-range feedback on this that helps to keep it. Good. So now if we just take this into the model, so now pressure will drive growth. Stresses will also depend on the shape of your tissue. You reorganize your material such that it leads to the maximum stress direction and make it stronger in this direction. You will get some strain, and that to some degree can change the shape. I do this one dotted because we think that when I talk about strain now, I talk about elastic strain. And we think that's only a few percent in the meristem tissue. If you plasmolyze them, they shrink with a few percent. So this is a kind of a small expansion compared to the irreversible growth that I will discuss later. But what I find a little bit interesting in this is that now we have no molecules, we have nothing, and we can, with this model, kind of define a patterning. So we get a central zone where the stresses are isotropic. It is strained less, and in the periphery, it strains more in the radial direction, more or less explaining the data without any kind of ideas of different molecules have to change the growth rates or anything like that. And we can take this a little bit further. So if you now play with a patch or a cell wall, and we pull it in different strength, and we add our feedback model. So if you start pulling much in one direction, it will become much stronger in this direction as well. And then the kind of stress anisotropy we can get from the curvature. So that one increases from the central zone to the peripheral zone to the stem. And we think the boundary might have the highest anisotropy, because you have this valley there.
Quick question. So you said it seems like you're relating the local curvature to the stress, to the local stress anisotropy.
Yes.
But if this thing is elastic, then these are global. You have to minimize some global energy. So can you explain exactly how you're justified in making this local constraint?
Yes, again, we have very kind of minor elastic deformations in the whole thing. So what we do is we run the whole tissue and we minimize the strain energy when we have applied the forces. And then you deform a little bit, but in principle you stay close to your original shape in this case. I have a whole thing on whether that actually can be like an energy minimization of the strain energy in these tissues, but I left it out from this talk.
What's local here is mechanical feedback, right? So you have some local stress, anisotropic as it might be, and it's generating material anisotropy by aligning microtubules.
Yep. But the models now is on the epidermis, so in principle it's a continuous sheet we are modeling. What's interesting then is that this one kind of marks when you actually your strain is in the same direction as your stress. Because you can be very strong and you can pull very hard, but if you just pull a little bit in the other one and it's very weak in this direction, you can actually move like this. So we kind of, using this with the feedback, we can kind of show that, so at this very boundary, it's isotropic. So that we can start with the central zone, we can explain the peripheral zone, now we grow in the opposite, or strain in the opposite direction, all the way to the stem, which is expanding in this direction, But we can put the boundary with such a strong stress anisotropy, so it actually can expand in the direction of the stress. And those cells are more or less expanding along the valley. So with the stress direction. So this model is capable of kind of creating this either grow parallel with the stresses or perpendicular with the stress. Okay. So back to the microtubules then. So what happens if we...
Have you tried the different shapes corresponding to different mutants, and do you still able to match where growth is fastest? I mean, in peripheral zone, that basic pattern with its
So we have a project where we try to find as many warp component that can perturb the shape of the meristem and see if we can explain that in models. The problem is the postdoc went to China and starting a new lab, so he has other things to do at the moment, but it hopefully will happen at some point where we have a good collection of all these shapes. But so far we don't grow large, so then we depend very much on what you put in terms of the shape. Okay, so what happens if we now remove the cell walls? So we get a protoplast, so we only have the membrane left here, and we can follow the microtubule dynamics. And not too much interesting in terms of patterning happen, or alignment happens in if you keep them as a sphere. So Pauline, a postdoc working with me and Elliot, thought, okay, what happens then if we take these protoplasts and squeeze them down into different types of shapes? And what she could find was that generally you don't get much of alignment or anisotropy, but if you have a rectangle shape with an aspect ratio, you actually have a preferred angle, and this is along the long axis of the rectangle, and there is an anisotropy if we measure the alignment of microtubules, suggesting that shape can be an input to how the microtubules can align.
But in the meristem, do you see any correlation between microtubule orientation and the shape?
I would say no.
It looks like it's correlated to me, no?
No. In the meristem?
In the meristem, I do think that the kind of tissue curvature wins over the local.
As you explained, but global stress.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone has really checked in very high detail. The problem is here, if this would be, I will come back to this. If this is a plant cell, most of the time we would expect the microtubules to be in this direction.
Yeah, exactly.
But we seem to have different qualitative opportunities. Is there any data that measured and published, you know, cell anisotropy, microtubule polarity, and look for correlations? Yeah, in the meristem. I mean, we talked about it, but is there any data?
Do you mean central zone or peripheral zone too? Like, you have those data.
We have some. We haven't quantified the meristem data in that detail yet. But this is something we would like to do.
Marcus yesterday, and there was again a sort of a.
Yeah, but this is one
quantitative answer, which may be true, but I think it's good to have some data that we can.
It would have been a good student project.
But it must be published, no? Come on, so many people looked at that.
Some of it, but.
Not in a comprehensive way that would be best yet.
Yeah. But I mean, here is one way where we try now to quantify things, because it's easier in these...
Because in every cell that I know, even bacteria, I mean, the equivalent, the cell has got an always aligned with the long axis. That's a default status. Now, any exception to that would be sort of regulated, I believe. And I even remember actually
we'll
a paper.
We'll
So it would be important that it be an exception. And
remember though that the microtubules here are running along the inside of the plasma membranes. It's a quite different to a yeast or whatever other type of cell.
They also have a wall.
Do they? But these guys are stuck to the membrane via.
Yeah. by doing live imaging at high resolution in time and space, as is required for following the microtubules, it's not easy.
Didn't Ferris publish a paper with microtubule orientation and with respect to cell geometry that argued that there was some kind of correlation, I thought?
So people have done similar things in animal cells. People have done it completely in vitro and see kind of similar things. That naturally, microtubules, if you just let them go without real input, it seems to they prefer the long axis. Good. And we then try to see if we can model this as well. So Thompson is doing some of these models. Ooh, I got some things coming. Where we model individual microtubules, they are growing with a little bit of random angle. So they are interacting with each other. So if they hit each other, there can be a catastrophe, there can be a severing event, or if the angle is small, they will bundle.
And you can combine them to the membrane?
And then they interact with the membrane, and we can do this in a hard way or what we call a soft way. The soft way is just that if you hit the membrane, you will not go through it, so you have to kind of adapt, and then you continue to grow randomly. Every time you try to go through the membrane, we push you back. The hard one is that if you hit the membrane, you actually will follow the membrane.
So you don't have actually any specific linkers that bind microtubules to the membrane?
No, so it's on-off. Either it sits there, or it actually, when we do the soft kind of thing, it tends to go to the membranes anyway. So.
There is evidence that there are linkers.
Right? Yeah. So, but our result doesn't depend on this too much. Good. So then if we run these models in different shapes, we can see the similar thing, that if we have a long direction, this is preferred by the microtubules in the models as well. And we get a higher anisotropy. And I discussed a little bit on the severing, that we can kind of break the mechanical feedback using severing. But here is the same thing. So if we reduce severing, we still kind of find the right angle, but the anisotropy goes down. And if you do the same thing in the model, and now it's a little bit interdisciplinary research here, so the biologists always want to control on the left, and then you have done your perturbation. Here we have a probability of severing, and it's zero here, and here it's the kind of wild type value. So it kind of goes down when you...
Are you quantifying these the imaged microtubules in 3D, or are you just looking at a projection?
Only the kind of top wall,
so
the projection of the
patterns that actually correspond to microtubules that are actually hit and happen to be going along with them.
Yeah.
And that's what you're comparing to also in the models?
Ask Thompson. But it is, or in the model, at least in the previous one, we did two planes,
yeah, upper so and lower. Yeah, we just considered the top and bottom, but we looked at both. But I think that was more a case of trying to get double the amount of microtubules to look at the anisotropy as much as anything else.
And then we did project microtubules then slightly off the membrane, onto the membrane.
Right. Are you also seeing there microtubules in the interior in these cells? And in other words, are your observations here consistent with microtubules being particularly stuck to the membrane, or are you actually seeing something that's not?
I think the majority is clearly at the membrane.
Okay, but your model doesn't.
And then the model has a little bit of a bias in terms of that the nucleation happens close to the membrane.
That's what I'm trying to say, is that your observations are consistent with some active protein linking microtubules to the membrane, whereas your model doesn't include such interaction.
As I said, we can have microtubules stuck to the membrane if we want. If they get close, they will stuck. So it would be an on-off.
If that's a mechanical?
No, so that would be keep it glued and continue to grow along the membrane.
Okay.
So it's a very kind of Boolean version of that.
All right.
Good. So then we come to the problem that in plants, this is an epidermal cell in a root hair, in a root that will create a root hair eventually. Quite often we see the alignment along the short axis. So what we can do in the models is actually that we can produce a small bias. So when we grow microtubules, if we say the probability, so typically when we grow, there is a small angle, maybe 3 degrees or something, where you kind of explore your space. If that is biased 10% in one direction, we can actually flip the whole thing from being mainly in the long axis to going for the short axis. So in this case, you can assume that this could be some input from the stress onto how the microtubules are growing. So it's a very dynamic system. If you don't do anything, it will go with the long axis, but it's very easy to bias it to go in any other direction, or at least a short one, as shown here. And I think Elliot also showed some of the pavement cells, so the kind of stress feedback idea. So these are the large cells on the epidermis of the leaf, and here we think that kind of you get an internal pattern of stresses and an internal pattern of microtubules, where they seem to choose some of these kind of short directions. And this is an AFM, so we also see that we have some stiffness kind of hubs. And this, if we run the models, is where we have higher stresses as well.
I mean, in these mechanical models, these are isolated cells, correct? So they're not feeling stresses from neighboring cells. These stress patterns are purely dependent on the shapes of those particular individuals.
Yeah, but we run them in tissues of cells as well.
You do.
And it looks similar.
Oh.
So in this case, I can't remember what you did with the boundary here, if you kind of kept that stuck.
You specified here that this is in young leaves, so does something different happen as the leaf gets much...
Yeah, and
cells get bigger, or what's the...
I think if you go longer in development, the kind of orientations might be different. The reason I say young is this experiment, where Arun cut or do an ablation, and you get this reorientation. If you do this at a later stage, you don't see the reorientation.
But here you're showing us sort of a mature stage of the pavement cell morphogenesis.
Shape, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, I guess it's possible that microtubules were organized independent of stress, but then through the wall, cellulose synthase deposition, there would be a polarized deposition of cellulose, which would then produce kind of a corset, which... owing growth to the cell would actually give rise to the observed stress. So in other way, it's not necessarily true. There's a correlation, but if it could be that actually microtubules are causing the pattern of stress through the
In the long run, we would like to have...
If you look at earlier stages, before the cell has this sort of very lobulated shape, maybe it would be slightly different. I mean,
Again, it's very hard. Arun is doing this. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to see if we can model this, and he do different perturbations as well to see where you get different end shapes and so on.
But I can't remember. I mean, I think in this pavement cells, there is kind of a row spatial pattern regulation
that's suggestion
that is responsible
for, that, yeah.
for. So do these row feed on microtubule regulation?
So the claim is that they're in interaction between the rows. That are two different rows.
Yeah, I can't remember.
One goes with the microtubules, the other one with pins.
But they have some kind of a length scale which produces kind of lobulations, don't they?
It's a little bit controversial, the data. If you ask Elliot, he do not believe the data. I've asked other people, I said also that to kind of get the raw signal in these shapes is very difficult, but I don't know. But that is not nothing, again, what then puts the raw there and the pins in other places?
I think I remember a study from Green and Sen and colleagues and John Innes, where they said there was some kind of local amplification, long-range inhibition kind of network was polarizing, similar to what you see in yeast and other things, which they argued was underlying that. But, I'm not a plant biologist, so I haven't looked in detail.
Oh.
Well, yeah, my problem is that it's, for instance, they claim that the pin protein is, alternating in distribution with some ROPs and things, but very few people have seen the pin protein in one in these cells as they're developing, as is claimed in this paper. So that's one major problem, I think.
I mean, the way I see the modeling and then these analysis is we see something, and in principle, are the models sufficient to explain what we see?
That's the first thing. I guess my question was, there's a correlation, but you know, to get to the causality,
The causality, I mean, people have looked for this for long, and people, there are some suggestions on how it could work, and so on. But from the data point of view, it's really hard to track them, and several labs are trying to do this now to really get to the kind of how do you generate the shapes.
Well, especially the feedbacks, you know, causalities.
Yeah. But you do change the shape, I guess, if you remove the market tubules, so somehow the... Yeah.
So it's kind of embarrassing, but I lost track a little bit of what we're looking at.
So this is a single cell in the epidermis of a leaf, a young leaf.
Yes.
And it's the microtubules.
Yes. And
here we have a finite element model of this.
And what exactly are the assumptions? What exactly are you modeling?
So here we just have an isotropic material, pressurize it, and I display the stresses.
What do we know about the shape of the cell? Now there's also the Z, right? There's a height, right? Presumably the top surface is not exactly.
So they are bulging out like this.
And your finite element is solving on the real shape, or it doesn't matter?
So it's in this case, I don't know if it's the same. So this one has, the kind of outline of this one has been taken from a real cell.
And
we run it within a tissue of several ones.
But how about the 3D shape? So is it the 2D finite element?
It's a 3D.
3D.
In this case, it's only the epidermal walls, and they are kind of, so when we have a tissue, we keep them rigid in the Z along the edges between the cells. And then we inflate.
So there are the walls, right? The cell for me is a room. There are walls. There is a ceiling. There is a floor.
Yeah.
So
this is the
I
ceiling.
See the walls. I can't see the ceiling or the floor. So in this picture,
that's the ceiling we're looking at.
This is the ceiling.
So you can't see the wall.
This is AFM.
The shape?
This is AFM of the ceiling.
But what?
Yeah.
What is the shape? Is it flat or is it
no? Or what, the shape of
like we're the
epidermal
volume of this cell.
No, I just want to know, are you solving it assuming that it's flat, or is it curved?
Okay. Here, it's the individual epidermal walls curve, and that we see in the plant as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And that kind of creates the stress patterns that helps to create the curvature as well.
That's the roof of the cell is curving.
Yeah.
What about the side walls, are they straight or are they also curved?
They we kind of assume are straight in this one.
Yeah, no, I'm happy with them being straight. But the finite element is done
on the surface.
Actual measured plant cell surface.
No. So the finite element, we take the anticlinal walls.
Yes.
We fix them in Z.
Yes.
And then we inflate from below to get a curved shape.
Assuming that this lid is, the roof is has uniform properties.
Yes, in this case, yes.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. But I think it's a very relevant question. I will just show also that we can then look at the stress directions and whether they're more isotropic and anisotropic, and that fits quite well with the microtubules as well. So I've taken out a slide where I didn't add it now. I used to show it. Where we actually tended to get, we had a stomata in the middle, and it was almost like circumferential around the stomata. And then we went back and looked at the kind of larger scale Z, and the stomata was actually popping out. So it looks like if it's reasonably flat, that the cell stresses dominate. If there is this kind of larger scale curvature, that can influence the patterns as well. And that did fit very well with the models we did about that.
Do you know what is the elastic strain in
these guys? No, I couldn't say now. If someone had done that kind of... Yeah. But now again, we can start running the microtubule models and also see that unless we have some kind of feedback, with the direction of stresses from our stress simulation, which is a 3D cell in this case, they tend to align along long axes again. And then you can have a weak and harder feedback, and you can align more and more along the stress axis. Again, kind of indicating a difference between if you break severing or if you are in wild type, that you get much more disorganization in a severing mutant. Good. But then what about growth?
To the extent that you already generated the correct shape and stress distribution without worrying about microtubule orientation or any anisotropy in properties. So...
Yes, the...
So ultimately, what do I conclude? That it doesn't matter that there is a bit of anisotropy generated by microtubules?
Usually not for the stress directions, I would say. But now we come to growth. and then I think it will matter. So I mean, long time people have shown that if you need to have pressure in many of the tissues to grow. And the idea is that the volume then grows proportional to the pressure, but there is some kind of yield threshold. So the pressure needs to be higher than a specific value, and then you typically assume it's a linear thing. And this, of course, I would, if I go to the wall now, connect to stresses. But many of these experiments are like one-dimensional experiments. You grow in one direction, and you don't take into account that you might have an anisotropic material. So what happens with these ideas if we have an anisotropic material? So now we have to introduce irreversible growth in the system. Now the shape change is mainly via this one, because the elastic strain part is only a few percent, and here we can grow magnitudes. And we have this kind of feedback. And now comes the question, is stress or strain or both leading to the irreversible growth? So I just show one slide on the growth model, but it kind of connects a little bit to the unifying discussion, because we model it very similar to what Boris kind of proposed. But we do this now in 2D elements, and in principle what we do is we do the elastic deformation, and then we have a resting shape and a actual shape, and the growth we apply to change the resting shape. And this we can do now in different ways. For example, say that it should go via the strain directions or stress directions or any kind of signal. And we allow to apply more irreversible growth in one direction than in another. So one of the kind of little bit interesting things are, I think Elliot showed this, but in some kind of context of a different one. So the problem is if you start a little bit with a shape, but you use stress now as your growth inducer for the irreversible growth, then even if you hold back in this direction, if you grow in this direction as well, ultimately you will create this kind of spherical shape. So we will suggest that this really suggests in many cases strain is a much better signal for your growth directions. So now in these models we have two ideas, that the material feeds back to stress directions and the growth go with strain directions. And as I showed before, these can be perpendicular or parallel depending on how anisotropic the generating stresses are. Okay, so but what about the shape and the size of this thing? So of course we can change this by changing pressure versus elastic properties of the material, but we still have issues in terms of typically the stress directions we get quite well. Previously I showed if you only had a meristem you could get actually strain direction quite well and relative strains, etc. But here, for example, we have very high stresses And this is actually area deformation as well. So it's very hard to not get large area deformations in these shapes. And at the very tip of the flower, for example, where we know we should grow fast, we don't grow fast. So a purely mechanical-based model can do a little bit, but not everything. So this is where we introduce also that morphogens can change things. And the kind of, we're coming from the auxin field, saying that auxin usually can make the walls less stiff. So we can change the young modulus from the morphogen. And that will lead to increased growth. And we can do this locally, and then we can see what happens. So one example is that if we grow our plants in different nutrient conditions, we know that the cytokinin levels change in the meristem, and we know that the meristem seems to be larger in the good condition. So this is the idea that cytokinin might regulate the growth, which might regulate then the size of the meristem. So here we just have a general diffusive morphogen that lowers the stiffness, and the further it can diffuse, or the higher the levels are, the larger your shape will become. But similar in terms of actual shape, it's more or less a scaling. And then I will come back to the auxin question again, but again, to get something suddenly growing on the periphery, we need something to induce growth. And this, again, we can say if auxin does this, then it's easy to create these kind of primordia growing out. But again, we need the kind of morphogens to do
all this. So far is only using mechanics of the shell, the outer cell layer.
Yeah.
So it still leaves open the question.
How much internal? But so what we do, so we have some with some cell layers, as you know, also for hypocotyls. And otherwise, we can also add forces. So if we have a cylinder, and I think the internal tissue gives a force in this direction, we can add that to the simulation. So we can kind of abstractly add influences from the internal tissues as well. Okay. I will not probably talk about the flower. Or you can make a choice. Do you want to hear about cell division?
What are the choices?
Yeah, and then I will do gene regulation, hormones, and then finally the flower a little bit. So, okay, let's do this one, and then maybe I skip to the flower, which is kind of the complete picture, because Marcus and Elliot has discussed lots about the phyllotaxis and so on. Okay, so if you look at the meristem, cells are growing. Here we have two time points overlaid. So the red one is later, and we can see that cell division has appeared. Almost all cells are divided at this point. And quite often that shows the shortest path, which could correlate then to the stress direction, as is discussed previously. But what I'm saying is that the plant is not adding growth per se when they add a wall, it just adds a new wall in the kind of volume ahead of the cell. So one question is, when do they do this? And before, I just want to show one movie of, again, when we take the cells out of the plant, so they have no cell walls now, and then they can behave very non-plant-like. So they start creating these blebs, and sometimes the nuclei move to the new one, sometimes it can move back and forth, and sometimes you create these blebs without the nuclei. So maybe some ancient thing happening. So the cell wall is important on specifying how you grow. So when do you divide then? And first, the first question is, do you change your cell size over time in the meristem? And we would say to a large degree not. So these are different plants, imaged for like 84 hours in this case, 76 in that case, and measuring the average cell size in the central part of the meristem over time. So it seems to be a size homeostasis going on in the meristem cells. As I mentioned, to then analyze how do you achieve this homeostasis. People have shown that it is quite useful to track a cell from its birth size and compare to the division size. And in all our previous models, we just assumed, for example, that when we reach a size, we divide. So that means you have no dependence on your volume at division on your volume at birth. And this has been seen to happen in like some yeast cells and so on. An alternative that has been found quite more recently, I would say, at least it's been hyped much more recently, is that many bacteria do not do like this. They rather add the same amount of volume between cell divisions. So by doing this, smaller cells add relatively more, and larger relatively less. And over time, you get homeostasis again. But it takes generations to reach your kind of equilibrium size, while this one would reset the size every generation. So now comes the question, what is a meristem cell? Is it more like a bacteria or a yeast cell? Of course, it's neither. So what happened was that we got a slope of 0.5. So being somewhere in between a sizer or an adder. You can explain this by saying you add the same amount over two generations, then you would get this slope, for example. But of course, we are in a plant doing differentiation, etc. So maybe there is two pools of cells behaving differently. But we tried to divide them in as many subgroups we could, and we could not find anything but very close to this 0.5 slope. And you can think of AND rules between these different rules and OR rules, and then it doesn't work because you would see biases for small cells or large cells and so on. However, what other people...
Can we just go back for a sec? Patterns in space.
Yeah, so if you would have a central cell and some differentiated cell, and they would behave differently in terms of division.
So you're saying that you have looked for correlations of nearby cells.
So here is more a region.
Right, but then, you know, because the obvious thing that comes to mind is, three alternative models were all for single cell organisms.
Yep.
Right, and this one isn't.
Yep.
So you might think that their decision is also dependent on what the neighbors are doing, right?
Yes. And that we have kind of checked to some degree in terms of number of neighbors and so on. The analysis we try to do as well, we take at division, we have two sisters, so they are kind of very close to each other in terms of environment, and compare how they behave quite a lot. Okay, but we couldn't find any correlations between anything. Yeah, I mean, here is, for example, large neighbors, small neighbors. And these guys, yeah. If you have some ideas, I'm happy to try.
Well, you have all these, right? So you can track the whole little neighborhood. You have a lot of division.
Yeah.
So you could, for example, correlate not just size, but rate of growth of neighbors, which would be a natural thing that correlates, since you believe that it's the stress that they're sensing.
This thing, we have no idea what they make the decision to divide, I would say. So what we have done a little bit lately, and other people have done this as well, is to connect this to kind of cell cycle models people have proposed for these kind of homeostasis models. So in the yeast cells again, people think that there is a kind of fast production of something that reaches a threshold and that decides when you divide, and it can usually lead to a sizer mechanism. And then there is this dilution idea, which can lead to an adder mechanism. And I just want to show this because you can actually, by combining these things and adding noise, etc., alter your slope. So even if you try to do an adder, pure adder, if you have some noise in the system, you can actually switch to other values. So by doing these comparisons, Lisa, who did the work, has kind of come up with 5 different hypotheses how you could get the slope 0.5. And some of it, I mean, there are some data in plant cells, in the meristem as well. So that there might be a possibility to go back to experiments and try to verify these things.
This is sort of trying to explain the 1/2.
Yeah. So to take, kind of base it on a sizer or an adder type of thing, add this kind of rules that skew those distributions, and you can reach 0.5 in different ways.
Well, of course, what strikes you from looking at it from the back of the room is that there's basically no correlation.
Yeah. I mean, that is a huge variability. But I mean, if you look at the single cell data, it looks the same. Good. Should I?
So
this is the final part was purely model.
Yeah, but the one before.
So our data is single cells within the meristem that we track. But when I talk single cell data, I mean, lots of people do this in bacteria and yeast and so on. It's very high throughput. In plants, it's not so high throughput.
So the way that they divide is different, right? E. coli is kind of a...
Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of...
Some are like rod-shaped. Some have this kind of buds growing out. And
then Pombi, I think there was a mechanical cluck that induces the division.
Yeah. So this is taking these things into account only in the way you grow and the asymmetry at division that there are statistics on, more or less. And we have statistics for that in the meristem as well, that you can put in as a parameter in the model. But the shape itself or anything like that is not at all included. Okay, should I do... I was inspired a little bit about the discussion yesterday on phyllotaxis. So maybe I do a few words on that. It's okay. And since I think both Marcus and Elliot mentioned Turing and claimed he was working on this when he died, I thought we had to have some evidence of that. So this is a letter he wrote to a friend, and when he's going to get his computer and says, our new machine is to start arriving on Monday. I'm hoping as one of the first jobs to do something about chemical embryology. In particular, I think one can account for the appearance of Fibonacci numbers in connection with Furcombs. So this is in the King's College archive in Cambridge. Okay, so to just summarize, more or less half of Marcus' talk, is that we have the idea that there is a feedback mechanism between auxin that changes the mechanics, changes the growth of cells, that leads to stresses, the neighboring walls that can help reorienting the PIN1. The original model didn't talk about mechanics, but rather said there is a feedback between auxin and neighboring cells. And it's based on several evidence in terms of data. What Marcus did not show, and is the kind of one of the main reasons we think mechanics is involved, is that if you do an ablation, the pin really goes orienting around the ablated region, similar to what the microtubules did surrounding the ablated region. And if we just remove signaling from this, as it would be a molecular thing, not much happens in our models. But if we do this with mechanics, we can actually predict much better the. And I will skip this because Marcus went through it, but I think it's a really nice set of data showing that if you just start auxin sensing in some cells, you actually can change the dynamics of your neighbors. Oh, I did a copy of this one. So first question might be then, how is auxin moved around in the meristem? And as described before, is that you typically get stuck within the cells. You need efflux carriers to take you out. Then you get protonated, and then you can flow quite freely in. But there are also influx carriers that do some kind of active transport. So if you now take a meristem, we segment it, we extract the pin levels we have in the cells, and we try to extract the membrane localization of the pins by just looking. So we do the segmentation on membrane marker, and then just look to the left and right of this membrane marker in 3D. It looks quite messy, I would say. Now I must say that the N here is quite low, so it's kind of preliminary things, but N is maybe 2 or 3. But then if we just run the model, so we kind of amplify whatever kind of pattern in pin there is, and see where does the auxin go, and we don't change anything with the pin, we just take them from we had from the data. We kind of create, we claim we use parameter values from the literature in terms of transport rates. We kind of create these kind of peaks of auxin in the positions where we would expect them to be, and where you can see the MP organized. What we also see is that there is a flow of auxin down into the plant, shown here in two kind of sections of the tissue.
So you can see offset between membrane and pin in the Z axis.
So what we do, we have a pin marker and a membrane marker together. So this is kind of the naive way of doing things. We segment.
Yeah.
That means we get a wall or the midpoint between two cells.
Yeah.
Then we more or less expand this volume a little bit, and whatever we get on that side is what is in the other cell, and we do the opposite. So we look at the voxels close to our decision point on both sides. Mm-hmm. And then just apply it, saying, okay, we assume this is on the left, that's on the right. And that's clearly bleed through, and that's clearly in the Z point spread. And these kind of things. So, but we just take the naive approach, see, can we get anything? And something happens at least.
So how does the auxin, so pins move or auxin in a layer, how does auxin get into the layer in the first place? Is it coming in from L2 uniformly?
So what I should say,
the top of, yeah,
as well. So I should have a cut of this one as well. So these are the pin levels. We also assume that the aux is doing something similar here, for reasons I might come back to.
Influx carrier.
So the influx carrier also, in these cases, have some patterns. And that could move aux in to be there.
So where is aux synthesized? So completely ignorant question.
Yes, so in our case, everywhere.
In the model.
In the model.
Not in the outline.
in the...
So I think this question is going to split into two questions.
Yep.
So exactly what's happening in the model? So all the cells in your simulation are...
So in some of the cases, we start with assuming this is also kind of representing auxin, because there's some correlation between pin expression and auxin. So this is the total pin in the whole cell volume.
But pins are pumping up the gradient, so
pins are pumping whatever they like in this case. We have just extracted whatever they do, and apparently they pump up the gradient. Or at least they are able to create, together with the influx carriers in this simulation, a peak of auxin here. A peak of auxin here, some peak of auxin here. So this is completely agnostic to what your pin theories are.
What's the relative contribution of influx versus efflux to these peaks? Okay.
So here we change 6 orders of magnitudes. The active influx, the active efflux. And I would say it's quite stable. What is kind of interesting is that if we don't have any influx and start carriers and start pumping with only pin, then we kind of lose the pattern. And what happens is actually the Hawking goes internally, so this is only showing the external layer, which we kind of didn't expect. So there is a pumping probably towards. I mean, it, if you increase it, you will recreate this, even without the influx. So the pins are important to generate the peaks, but if pin becomes too dominating, it actually will just flow down the drains in this simulation.
He assumes the distribution of the influx current. You haven't measured this.
Yeah.
And you just assumed it's in the peak.
Yep. But I mean, here we assume that there is no contribution of the influx carrier.
Yeah. But the other way with the efflux. Yeah.
Okay.
And so you.
I mean, we change all the parameters. So,
yeah, yeah.
We have situations where we have very high but symmetric.
Right. But you can get the peaks in the right place without any efflux and only using the influx.
Yep.
With the complete assumption, though, that the influx
is localized there. Yeah. Yep. I mean, there are some biases here, but for example, the auxin initial bias is not required, so it can regenerate from no pattern in auxin. We can remove at least one of them and still have the patterns. But it seems here that both are kind of useful to the patterning process. And again, this is six orders of magnitudes in changes in the parameter value, so I would still argue it's relatively robust to what we do. But maybe more interesting then is that the pin polarization thing. And I want to approach this from a little bit the dynamic point of view, and why would we need stresses to be measured differently in a wall, for example. So the original model said, okay, auxin in one cell affects the endocytosis of pin. This you can equally do by increased exocytosis, you can reduce endocytosis. No matter at all. You can use, for example, auxin in the wall if you allow that in this part of the wall and that part of the wall are different concentrations.
So here you're exploring alternative hypotheses.
Yep.
About how pin is controlled, and
yep.
Now you're talking about auxin concentrations in the wall as
yep.
a possibility.
I mean this could be any variable.
Right.
But if this one is homogeneous in terms of the value of the variable, you cannot use that as information for the pin. Oh, you. If it is different, you can use it as information. But we think auxin is, of course, moving very quickly, so we don't think in an auxin scenario that would be possible. So, on the other hand, if I do auxin in this cell affects the pin on this membrane, where I don't do the acycling, I just change the value of my pin, it will not work. If I use the value from here and it's homogeneous, again, it will not work. And by not work, what happens is you cannot adjust your wavelength. You will always get a kind of this kind of every second cell type on-off. And if we now do kind of the simplest version of the model, we might have some production degradation. In each cell that we actually can discard if we want. We have diffusion between cells, which we in principle could discard if we want. And then we have our active transport driven by the pin. In this case, I did a Michaelis-Menten type of thing, but you can just have the linear if you want. And then assume that you affect the kind of cycling of pin with, it can be a function of A. It should be more than the square root of A, then you can get pattern. If it's linear or more, you will always be able to get pattern independent of the other parameters. I mean, you can remove patterning always. And now if we get the cycling, then you take from the total pool of pin in your cell and distribute it to the membranes, which means that how much you have in cell I pointing on J will also depend on your other neighbors, folks in concentration. And this is the trick when we then do a linear stability analysis, because now we can put this expression in for the pains, and we have a single variable equation. We can do find the homogeneous fixed point, and we can analyze how it is perturbed. And this is kind of the eigenvalue distribution, and the highest one is usually connected to the type of pattern you see. And in our case, we then do, So in principle, what we can say, for example, is if we change the ratio between the diffusion and the active transport, we actually change the wavelength of the pattern, which we like. And the problem then with those kind of interactions that didn't work is that you don't get a contribution in your equation from the next neighbor, and that means that this one will only be linear. So you can get it to pattern, but you cannot adjust where you have your peak of lambda, which is setting the wavelength of the system. So I don't know if this helped in terms of understanding why we, for example, needed the subdivision of the wall in the stress feedback model, because that put you one step away, and that contributes to your kind of linear stability analysis. So then mathematically, we can map the stress model onto a concentration-based model and things like that. But this means now that you can adjust your wavelength. The other thing I want to discuss a little bit, because it was kind of discussed yesterday as well, is that there are some problems with this model. So I think Elliot always claims that the original model had included that auxin induces pin expression. But we avoided that for a reason that it's not always seen in the linear stability analysis, but when you run the simulations, if auxin induces the pins, then suddenly you start pumping quite a lot away, and you get instabilities. So the peak starts moving. And now we can rectify this, as me and Marcus showed in another paper, that if you also induce the influx carriers, you can kind of compensate for this and get stability.
So does it mean that you naturally get this spiral wave instability, like what
Marcus showed you? So this is actually... we use this as an adaptation to the model, which I can show now. I just want to say that we are now trying to connect this with Marcus Kahn-Rev models, or we have connected it in one way, in terms of if we just run the model, we would get the peaks anywhere. Marcus nicely showed that the peaks are generated in the boundary between the Rev and the Kanadi. So if we have Kanadi and Rev, or at least one of them, reducing the activity of MP, that's sufficient to generate the peaks in the position suggested by the gene regulatory network. And then I love this so much, I have to show it, even if Marcus did. He didn't show this, though. So here again is from our simulation of pins in wild type. It looks like it pushed the auxin down into the plant. This is a wild type plant. The auxin goes down. Here is this mutant where he added MP only in the epidermis. And you really see there is no connection or very little connection with the layers below. So from a modeling point of view, the difference, one of the differences here is that in this case, you actually retract auxin from your auxin peak. So in the model, we take the old model and we change one thing, and that is we remove auxin from the high auxin peaks, and that can actually stabilize the pattern. So I actually, this is if we don't do this, homogeneous kind of removal of auxin, we have pin-induced bioauxin, and you get the instability, but you can again stabilize it by removing auxin in the appropriate times. And this is, of course, a very simplification. And then if you add growth and so on, you would expect to see these spirals. Okay, are we tired?
What happens if you don't have MP inducing it? That's very stable. So no auxin induction at the peak. That's well.
Yeah. More
yeah. Then you typically get a stable peak. Yeah. I mean, you can have two time scales in terms of you create one pattern first and then a slow merging of peaks and things like that. In some, I mean, depending on your parameter values. Okay. You want to hear 10 minutes about the flower, or is it? Okay, so here again we have segmented and tracked in 3D the cell lineages in early flower development. And currently now we kind of try to get understanding of all of this at once. But I mean we are more or less first now generating the kind of data such that we can probe different types of models. So we can see we if you take a single cell or a few ones here, they create these different patches in different parts of the flower, and it looks very similar in the L2 layer, which is just below. If you compare different flowers, the way we did this was that we took, I don't know if it's our favorite, but here we had a very long time series. And then we took our flowers, and this one we did interpolation, so we had like 1 hour delta T. And then we take another flower and try to map it in different time points and find the correlation that is the kind of optimal shape in terms of similarity. And we could do that for more or less all but one of the samples we had. And the reason why we didn't did an average template here is that we did want to follow the cell lineages, which you would have lost if you try to kind of average out, because the cell positions and divisions and so on are not the same in different places. One thing we see is that the time it takes to develop seems to be quite different in different flowers. So the first one show that the shapes you see, you can actually correlate quite well. But the time to reach these shapes seems to be quite variable in different flowers. Whether this is a technical problem in terms of we do the imaging, flowers are not always happy when you do this and so on, it's hard to say. We just can say we see these things. Now what we try to do is we have lots of data of low-res meristems and flowers. So now we in those kind of data, we can extract the surface shape. And here we have just sorted them, like 500 of them, depending on size, which is not working too well. You need to take into account the kind of morphologies as well. But this question on how do you quantitatively compare shapes and which ones are next to which is still a little bit open for us in terms of we don't have the best methods for this. Okay, so here it's having two meshes, and how do you compare similarities of the shapes of these. So if you have ideas on that, I'm very happy to learn. Okay, so then we can follow growth, a little bit like Adrian did. Now it's in 3D, and we can look at consecutive time points. And the general trend is it starts growing fast, in particular in the outer sides of the sepals. And this one should come after I introduce the genes. But so then on top of this template, we have mapped gene expression for 30 different genes, about 30. And now we can ask, is there a correlation between the expressing cells and growth rate? Is this gene a growth driver? And what we see is that we have a few of them that kind of seems reasonable. Clavada 3 is growing slow, for example. But many of those connected to fast growth also have slow growth. So they have a huge variability in terms of cell growth if you just map them all. So then, of course, when you have all these gene expressions, if you look at the different cells, they will have a combination of them on and off. So we have what we call a cell state. And after some cleaning and so on, knowing which one should not overlap and which should and things, we more or less get about 30 states in this early development of the flower. And this we can then map back on the flower. So now each color represents one of these kind of binary vectors of expression.
So I guess with these, so looking at the first set of data where you had something like a lot of three, which there's not a lot of variation in there, but it's also marking a really specific defined set of cells. ATML1 is going to mark all of the cells.
Yeah.
So in some ways, the variability doesn't surprise me that much.
No. But if you want to claim ATML1 is a driver for growth.
But it's also just letting you say that if you look at the population of the entire population of cells, that's going to be more variable than a very small population of cells.
Yeah. Yeah, that is I agree that that might, or there is a correlation on this, of course. Which we see that, for example, the green one here is represented. The difference from here is just one gene, HP6, and that one was actually the one that showed a high growth in general. So there is this kind of correlation. Okay, but now we can kind of just do unsupervised clustering of this and in principle find back different regions of the sepals or of the flower in different places, which is not so surprising because I chose them to kind of have a pattern that is important for plant development. But it's kind of a consistency check. But now with the lineage data, we can also kind of connect them. So we can see that we have some of these states, these binary vectors, contribute to a specific part. And it's quite a little bit messy, but there is at least some kind of information in the paths. And we actually have weights on this if we would like to add that.
Can I ask, so those salty markers you chose, like they are the ones that marking specific zones that
So they are chosen as being important for, people have suggested them as important
for
all flower development. Yeah.
So have you looked over the spatial correlation between growth differences and expression patterns?
Yes, so that's the point then, that if we use, here are again the genes, if you use these states, so it's a combination of genes now, then we get better kind of differences between the different ones. And then, for example, what we have working with is see what is the kind of overlap between these two, for example. So we now have a suggestion that this specific state might be actually a driver for
growth. Right, have you, I mean, there are different states, but it's also just simple information is how autonomous is a gene functioning in terms of from growth. So how many of those states represent states that include I guess you have to
So this is where we're coming at, but we also assume Boolean things here and no diffusing transcription factors and things like that. So we are currently moving things to a continuous world where these kind of things will be able to address.
I'm trying to understand the meaning of that tree a couple slides back. So the tree itself is
so this is time.
Just lineage, right?
Yeah, so
the states are defined by some combinations of genes that are on.
Yep.
If I look at the given gene, do I find it occur in different branches of the tree? Right? So once I turn on a given gene, do I ever turn it off?
Yes.
So the genes, therefore, are sort of sprinkled relatively sporadically onto this tree. And I'm trying to understand is how does the existence of that tree, lineage tree, constrain the patterns of combinatorial patterns of genes?
I mean, I will come to that. For example, how much can we predict the gene expression at this time point if we follow the lineage from this standpoint. But if you follow this cell, you can directly see it ends up here, and now the green is over here. So there must be some patterning process happening. In this case, it cannot be just lineage. Yeah, I mean, I have several small things here, so just stop me when it's time. The thing with the lineage now is that we can really track cells from 10 hours all the way to 132 hours. So instead of doing this consecutive investigation, you can do it over longer time periods. And what we see, for example, is that if we track the cells that are present all the way through the development at time 10, and then color them on how much did the final clone grow, it looks like there is no strong spatial signal here at that time point. It's quite random magnitude of the colors. If you look at 96 hours, and why this is interesting is because you don't really see any morphogenesis happen. It's more or less a bowl still. There has been happening some gene patterning, but if we don't care about this, but just look at individual cells, starting from 96 hours, how much will they contribute at 132 hours? We really see now there is a spatial patterning. So already here, they could have been specified, you should grow fast. We don't see anything in the data, in the growth rates, but if we look over long, long times, we can see it. And similar in this kind of graph, where we now have colored the growth rates in the different states, we can see that these are contributing a lot to the growth that happening here much, much later. But at the time when we identify it, they haven't started growing yet.
Do they mark the lineage that grew?
Yes, so here you can see that these are parts of the sepals. So clearly these are growing fast. And somehow these are kind of the kind of first marking of the sepal ring.
So they do mark the sepals. Those states mark the sepals. Damn it.
Yeah.
Those states mark those domains down there.
Yeah, so there is quite a lot of overlap between this and this here, we can see. And here we can really see, I don't show it well here, but in principle these are the ones contributing to this one. If
those
you do the
colors
weights.
Don't correspond to those three states, 9, 11, and 8.
No, so this is independently colored. Bright means
right,
growing slow.
It'd be interesting to map exactly where those
yeah.
9, 11, 8 states
are. I would say these are those. And we were asking why 12 contributes as well, which is this one, and it didn't show up in our lineage tree. But I think it's there, but we have a threshold for how much of the lineage needs to be there.
Maybe if you could bring us home to a logical stopping point, and we promise not to distract you with questions for a few minutes.
So I want to show one thing, because we also have information on what people have suggested in the literature in terms of regulation. And what we did was we created Boolean models of this, since we had a Boolean expression domain, and asked, if we only go from input to output, so we keep the inputs static, use these rules, but in all possible combination, because if you have three activators, are there ands and ors and so on, and we kind of tried all of these possibilities and selected the best one. And I just want to do the summary. I could have done that directly. And if we, for example, look at lineage, it's maybe not completely obvious here, but if you do the averages of how well they do, so red is good, white is bad. It actually is doing best in the beginning and the end and kind of dips in the middle. So the kind of idea is that initially you grow quite slow, which means that lineage could be quite good in predicting. Towards the end, you grow fast, but you have already done your patterning, so you just expand. The literature network, again, sometimes works very well, but quite often very badly. And if, yeah, I don't show the averages in this one, but in principle, if we look at it by adding one hypothesis, saying, okay, select a random gene or optimize which gene to select and add that as an input arrow, we can improve quite a lot. Kind of show, I mean, we add the parameter, of course, but it kind of shows that the current network is not complete. And we might even remove arrows, and that can improve things as well. And now we connect this also to the mechanics. So now we play with the idea that with the stress feedback that we always need, we also add input from the cell state on the mechanics in terms of the stiffness. And we see that with an isotropic one, we cannot create any nice shapes. Stress feedbacks help, but adding this additional information on fast-growing cells have lower Young modulus in these models improves it even more in terms of how we can grow the things. And with that, I just hope I've seen... You've seen examples now that it is important to connect these different pieces to be able to understand the growing meristem. So thank you for your patience with my timing.